Hi, everybody. Jason Klom here. A couple corrections before we get this episode of Phil Proctor started. First of all, the Trepanny fundraiser that he mentions is at the Steve Allen Theater here in Los Angeles on Saturday, June 24th. I believe he says it's the 29th, but it's in 10 days, the 24th here. And he also mentioned that the SARP actor who played Nick Danger is David Stiefel, not Steele. So he just wanted to make sure I made those corrections. Now the episode is, you'll enjoy this. It's a good time with him and Firesign Archivist Taylor Jessen talking about the history of Firesign Theater. This is part four, talking about Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. Enjoy. I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast.
You see, that's the thing. Let's start the interview. Well, we've started the interview.
Yeah, we should officially start it. Yeah. The year is 1970. The album is Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. The group, Firesign Theater. And my guest this week, Taylor Jessen. And once again, Phil Proctor.
I prefer to think of it as 1969 when we
did Of course.
It was a sexier year than 1970.
Naturally, yeah.
70 was the beginning of the end, let's face it.
Sure, for everybody.
scanning instrumentics. Scanning pictures. Pictures. I have thousands, probably 10,000 pictures and negatives in various boxes and barrels and things in my garage. And it was one of those things where I think 20 years ago I said it would be a good time now to go through these pictures, and you know,
yeah.
And I said to somebody, I said, well, what I'm planning to do is I'm going to save the ones I want and then I'll scan them and save them and I'll throw away the negatives. She said, why do you throw away the negatives? I said, well, that's the point of it, isn't it? You know, you get rid of the pictures.
Right.
No, I think you told me you have to save the negatives.
He would be the guy.
No, Phil, God's sake, don't throw away the negatives.
Of course, I would have said the same thing.
I was just thinking about that the other day. The only reason is that in there's original objects, and no matter how far the technology goes forward, it seems you can always go back and clean them up to some degree that wasn't possible 10 years before.
Even so dirty pictures?
The dirtier the better.
Oh my God. But you see, I was raised with songs like by Johnny Mercer, like you got accent I can't remember the song.
Accentuate the positive.
You got accent the positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. in between.
You took a little too literally.
Well, I guess I did, but you know, I was indoctrinated at an early age. My mind was still soft and mushy at the time.
Johnny told me to throw away this
stuff. All the research that I had to do for the book was down in my office, and it had, you know, had to do with pulling out files and things and pictures, and oh my God, it went on for months and months and months, and now I can't find anything. I was going to bring another little book of, you know, what happened in 1969.
Yeah.
Now, I have a vague recollection that that's possibly, it was 67, was it, the last time that I had a book? Doesn't
yeah,
matter.
Which one did we do? 67? No,
68.
I think it was 68. I will say 68.
Yeah, so 69 is sitting there somewhere.
Yeah.
But I don't know where it is.
Oh, no.
I can't find it.
So
it's worse than a thumb drive, you know?
Yeah.
And going my way. going past me. So I couldn't bring any of that lovely research material so I can look and go,
sure.
Oh, yeah, I remember her. You know, and oh, I wonder where my child is now from that alliance. It was a wonderful time, a very creative time. Fireside would ride out there. We had this beautiful, we were renting this house from Dr. Adolf, who was a famous radiologist. And it was rock and roll. I mean, it was marvelous.
Is this the house where Phil Austin once spent an evening in an aqualung at the bottom of the pool?
I don't think so. We didn't have an aqualung. No, we.
Somebody told that story during the XM shows.
I don't even think Phil Austin. Why would he want to spend an evening in an aqualung?
Too late to find out. I
That's
would.
True. Well, get out the Ouija board. Yeah. Maybe he'll,
indeed,
you know.
Indeed.
Wait, Dr. Adolf. There's an Adolf on this album. I feel like that does it now.
There is an Adolf on this
album.
Now
I'm assuming that's just
its
own joke.
No, I believe.
Was it a reference?
That this was, although I can't be held accountable for it, but I believe that I might have been living in this particular house at this particular time.
Okay.
You know, I know that I wasn't married or anything, not until 71 when I met Sheila. And I didn't do the movie A Safe Place until 70, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was right after Dwarf. You got on the...
Yeah, right after Dwarf. Mm-hmm. So Dwarf was a really wonderful period, very creative period for us, and an opportunity to work and write together and perform together, because it was... We had just finished our second album, How Can You Be in Two Places at Once, You're Not Aware at All, and Nick Danger, Third Eye,
mm-hmm.
Which means I was still with Kathy Cozy then. Okay, that's getting murky, because she didn't live with me at the big mansion, so maybe I wasn't at the mansion then. I won't mention the mansion again. But in any event, we wherever it was that we wrote,
yeah,
probably Bergman's house, maybe wherever he was, and we would then perform the material at the Ash Grove, which is now the Improv.
Okay.
In the tradition of the Marx Brothers, who used to perform up at the Libero Theater, try out their material. We really had we had established ourselves as a comic success because of Nick Danger, mm-hmm. primarily, which so many more people could relate to.
So what, just to talk about that, because Taylor would be more familiar than I would be, but like, what about Nick Danger? Like, what did Nick Danger do for you?
Well, first of all, the story behind Nick Danger, which...
I don't think we ever talked about it, actually.
Okay,
much.
Dave Osman talks about it a little differently. His memory is a little different from mine. But who cares? we both agree that...
You were in different rooms with different sound effects machines.
Yeah, right. No,
you can have
he was
memories.
In the echo chamber. The fact is that Nick Danger was a pilot for a continuing series that we wanted to perform as part of one of the ongoing Radio Free Eyes shows.
Okay.
And I believe that we were at KPPC at that time. But I remember we wrote the pilot and we took it out to perform it on the radio for the first time, kick off this series, to discover that we were locked out of the studio. I think it was a Sunday night broadcast or something. They had...
Was this Cam E.T.?
Could be. I don't know. Some radio studio, you know, they're all the same, you know, they're either on the, mm-hmm. they're on a penthouse or they're in the basement, and you know, and in LA it's just a building somewhere.
And you get to go in five times and then you're fired.
You're fired. And they had changed management. It was now a Hasidic rock, Hasidic cowboy, uh-huh. I think is what they were doing. And so we couldn't do Nick Danger and we couldn't kick off this wonderful series. So we said, well, what are we going to do with it? And in those days, as I think I've already pointed out, the album had two sides.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It had two sides, mm-hmm. see? And in fact, I think on this one, we call it Side One and the Other Side.
Yes.
That's how this mm-hmm. is described. So we said, well, let's just put it on the other side, okay, of the How Could You Be mm-hmm. album. It was fine.
Yeah.
So we did. And expanded it, of course. And we didn't perform Nick Danger. That was all a writing job and then working in the studio.
Okay.
But it was a breakthrough because more people could relate to the parody format.
Okay, sure.
Which was noir detective movies and radio, mm-hmm. particularly. And so it was a familiar format that people could relate to on several levels, and that's what turned a lot of people onto Fireside. They could follow the story.
Okay, that makes sense.
The characters, all right? Identify with the characters because they were in many ways stereotypes.
And it was really the goofiest thing you'd ever done to that point. I mean, the rest of the albums have laughs on them, but it's also really kind of turn your head laughs.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
It's true. I mean, the College Boy ruled, I would say, in the earlier albums, Bergman and I, and David, who was, you know, New York intellectual background too, more than Phil, who was from Fresno.
what are you going to do?
And who had been trained in the psychological warfare division of the Army. Did you know
Holy
that?
Shit,
yeah.
No.
When he was drafted, he was assigned to the psychological warfare division.
That explains so much.
A lot about Phil's sense of humor. And he also had gone to Fresno High School or college or, I don't know, Theosophical Institute with Richard Schulenburg. And Richard Schulenburg ended up through various manifestations of time as the lawyer at Columbia Records. Mm. So we would go into to Richard Schulenberg's office, Phil Austin's college roommate, or some kind of roommate, and he would explain, he'd go through all the contracts, and in layman's terms, Austin would translate it into psychological warfare
sure.
terms, and then we would sign, you know, false names to the contracts and make records. So anyway, to get back to that album, it was, we were now established, and so we kind of, when we went into the writing, and we're making a little bit of money from doing this, when we went into the writing of the album, we felt that we were kind of liberated to do this, the trilogy. This was the third part of our trilogy that we designed.
Okay.
The albums. And I guess we took as inspiration A Day in the Life by the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he blew his mind out in a car.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. And we made it into A Life and the Day. And our premise was sitting alone in your home or apartment watching television.
Mm-hmm.
And we invented the idea of channel surfing. Instead of having to get up and turn the knob, we invented this idea of just going click, 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 so that we could use the instantaneous change from one scene to another as a theatrical convention,
mm-hmm.
which was very liberating to us because we'd all sat stoned in front of a television watching things and turning channels for such a long time.
Sure.
It was all part of our DNA. And again, something that we could share with everybody else because television was becoming more obsessive in people's lives, especially at late at night.
Yeah.
And so we decided to write several skits and things that would fit into a format, including commercials and talk shows and, you know, various things that you'd see at movies and things. And we put them on stage at the Ash Grove with appropriate costumes and masks and things that I bought at Hollywood Toy Store and other people brought into the mix and tested it out in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And that helped to refine the work and the writing,
mm-hmm.
and also for us to find what worked and what didn't, the rejection of things. I remember part of that, we called it the TV set,
uh-huh.
okay, or A Day in the Life. Pardon me, A Life in the Day. And one of the things that we did was a cartoon show where we all had, you know, silly animal
masks. Oh, my God.
On.
Okay.
And I found an MR-13, some horrible Vietnamese war weapon, mm-hmm. in plastic with a loop of gunfire on it.
Okay.
It was the best day.
It's amazing.
I still had it. Bang, 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 bang. And so what we did with the cartoon thing was funny characters who made funny sounds, and then I came out as a funny character with a helmet on and killed them all with this gun. And they all died horribly. It's a cartoon.
Yeah, love it.
Visual. So, but that didn't make it to the record. Right. It was kind of visual, really, when you think about it.
There's a really good...
and visceral, too.
There's a good capture of that in the very last show for the Magic Mushroom, which was Life in the Day.
Oh, really?
And that will be part of the upcoming.
Mm-hmm. No, that's outgoing.
MP3 release of the full Magic Mushrooms, which are ready to go.
Wait, how did you differentiate between what's going on and what's on the television? Since it's predominantly what's happening on the television.
Oh, but the stage show that we did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we'd evolved the George Tyrell.
Oh, okay, record. Okay, I see what you're saying. All right.
Okay.
Okay.
It was more or less just click, you know.
Yeah, on stage would have a clicker.
Oh, that's great.
From bit to bit, some of those bits were just even two lines long, and then you'd
that's
click
right.
to the next thing.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Fantastic cigarettes. Yeah. Fantastic. Click.
Click. Yeah, right.
Great. Okay.
Right.
All right.
And that really, that's so Firesign Theater,
mm-hmm.
you know, and really nobody else ever did that,
mm-hmm.
you know, not even Monty Python. Lots of people would do, you know, fully formed skits and things.
Sure.
And the Python would come as close to it, but, you know, and now for something completely different.
Yeah.
You know, they understood that leap, that comic leap, and the effect that it could have. And they, but they could do it visually, which made it easier to understand. And so we played with the rhythms and the music of it more. But when we when we evolved the piece into a phonographic format, we added the character of George Lori Tirebiter, based on the mascot of what, UCLA or USC, I can't remember.
USC,
which was a stray dog.
Oh, that's
that
right.
Became its mascot. Loved to chase cars, so they called him George Tirebiter.
Photographs exist. You can Google this dog. He's
His handsome dog.
I think I've seen that, yeah.
And he was run over by a car eventually. And Phil Austin called the album the Five Stages of Man album.
Uh-huh.
Because what he said was it takes, which is true, it basically is a story of an old guy who is reviewing his life in fugue states as he drifts between sleep and awareness, watching late night television in which they're playing old movies that he did when he was a star in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fantasy in that regard that he is reliving, but he's also reliving his past from being a child actor to, you know, a character, leading man, let's say, and then a character actor. And so then
before we get into the meat of the album, can you talk about the revival prologue? Where did that come from? Because I know Austin was he was really obsessing about revival shows all through Radio Hour in the summer of 70.
Well, the whole Let's Eat.
Yeah, Pastor Flat.
Yeah, it basically, I think part of that inspiration came out of the fact that where I was living out in Encino, I think I was living in Encino at the time, on Ventura Boulevard, there was a church that had a spire that inspired me to think of a television antenna. It was it was very spindly and I thought, this is God's message is coming through this television antenna to this particular congregation. And that was the little, I think that idea sparked the concept of, we're going to give you a religious experience.
I love it.
You know, electricity is giving you revelation, you know, that from the heavens, from the ether, if you will, through the antenna device down to your machine with these little rabbit ears on it, you are then getting all of this revelation, this information. What are you going to do with it?
It was a very deliberate extension of the metaphor of the electricity that you've been riffing on.
The electrician, wave electrician, or something like that. But it also, of course, represented the power of evangelical television, you know, and the idea of making a mighty hot dog is our Lord. It's almost like, you know, you're feeding the congregation that which they're hungry. They're hungry for salvation. They're hungry, you know, to feel a part of a group. They're hungry to find a way, a reason for living, and all of that. So you're feeding them with this kind of spiritual food, if you will. A mighty hot dog is our Lord. It's something that nurtures your soul that you need, you know, to live. And of course, George Lori Tirebiter, in his fugue state, really reaches into the television and takes out his hot buttered groat clusters or whatever, you know, and is really actually able to eat. Because, of course, they don't serve up in the hills. We always posited a post-apocalyptic world of some sort, or a totalitarian world, you know, where basically there are restrictions on what you could do in that world, and they don't serve in certain sectors after an hour because it's maybe dangerous.
Right.
Well, is it still part of the Firesign world where it's post World War II, but the ending wasn't the same ending as it was?
Right. We surrendered.
Right.
Right. In World War II, we surrendered, and therefore we're living in this concentration camp, if you will. If you concentrate hard enough, you can get out of it, but
Still. I notice on the album we do not get a definitive answer when they shout out, "Who won Second World War? You so
yeah,
smart!"
Right, exactly.
No answer.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I know. Winners and losers. It's a, quite a metaphor. But anyway, we're in a concentration club, as Saturday Night Live put it so well. But anyway, so that adventure really came out of George's of our main characters. Observations on the something which we were all commonly sharing. Now, back to the physical album.
Yeah.
There's there's something I have to describe about this side of the album.
Yeah.
And it says here before and after. And the before pictures are us in some of our masks. There's the George Papoon mask,
mm-hmm.
which I found. And then that's one of the masks from the cartoon mm-hmm. series, the duck, and then of course
Uncle Sam
and a frog. There just always has to be a frog. Could be a prince.
Sure, why not?
And then yes, and the ice cream and baggage claim.
It's amazing.
Those.
It's amazing.
But there it is. There's the machine gun. There's the gun.
Oh, that's the one. Okay, sure.
Nice.
That's the gun.
Yeah.
With the loop in it, which mm-hmm. is probably on the album somewhere.
Phil, that effect. Photo session is pretty crazy. That's like mid-69.
Is that John Rose? Do you know?
I don't know. I think it's the four of you. But there's somebody else in the room with you.
The girlfriends are there
in the room. They're wearing masks, too. Yeah. Okay. There's other shots that...
Some of those are in the poster.
Included. Yeah.
Yeah, they're in the poster.
And one shot was included in the book of the four of you plus two girlfriends standing on the stairs. And somebody has fake tits over real tits.
Yep, that's right.
There's a plunger. Yep. So that was... This was
all things I found at Hollywood Toy Store.
Amazing. Photos that you see in this era were some of them all came from one massive session of weirdness, which was great.
Well, that was easy in those days. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the second picture is us performing together in the studio. But it says after here, and that's not what I originally wrote. What I wrote was AFTRA,
mm-hmm.
because we joined the union. The American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, we joined the union when we made this album. So this was supposed to say before and after. But
does it say before and after somewhere else? Because I remember seeing that joke on some Farsight product, but now I don't see it on this LP.
They corrected it.
Interesting.
And I didn't get to proof it, and I didn't get to say, no, it should be after. So anyway, but now you know. April and May 1970. Well, it says we actually wrote and performed it in 1970.
Huh.
Who can remember?
well, what's great about listening to Radio Hour Hour from the summer of 70 is that you can hear all the little random, real found objects, text objects, that later appear in Dwarf. Times two postal service workers yields how many? Yeah. That's all from a Creative Playthings ad for like a bus, a multicultural bus.
Yep.
Wow.
A toy. And then
The figures. I had the little I still have some. I have the postman and the milkman who are cut out of wood with paintings on them, you know. And what was the other bendable integrated workers or please.
Code your answer now.
Oh my God.
And the first time and
Bill Dremel.
And it's them, you know, them. Name three. You can hear in the radio show where Bergman comes out with that line for the first time, and then there it is on the album.
Yeah, and this was also, as you can see if you read the credits, a very collaborative album.
Mm-hmm.
All the wives and husbands were on good terms and all talented. They could all sing and join into the chorus elements of this, the Porgy Tirebiter song and all that. And Bill Dremel and the other engineer was Jerry Hockman. Hockman and Chynik, I remember was his name. They were the engineers at Columbia Square in the original studios that had been used for radio shows.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, I think, our last album in under the auspices of these non-union, if you will, of the regular employed engineers at the studio,
mm-hmm.
who of course had never heard anything like what we were doing,
right?
And were wonderfully inspired by it and helped us realize a lot of our audio dreams. You know?
Yeah. Where were those studios? Where are they now? What location is that?
They're still there, but it's they're television news studios now.
Which one?
It's in Hollywood on Gower.
Oh, okay.
Gower and Sunset.
Oh, Sunset Gower. Okay. There we go.
Yeah.
Duh.
The original Hollywood
studios.
I
forget that that's always Columbia. Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. That's right. Okay.
CBS Columbia.
Okay.
And I remember during our success in our venue as guests, as artists there, they eliminated the studios and subdivided them into A&R offices.
Mm, okay.
Because as Columbia became more successful as an outlet for musical groups and rock and roll and all of that, as the industry of LPs took off, they needed more and more management, a sales force, publicity force, and it just the actual creative forces had to go elsewhere to do their studio work,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, was fine, but it was a distinct, palpable transition mm-hmm. that we were all aware of. That's where we got to know Mike Oakes really well, Phil Oakes' brother, because mm-hmm. he was one of our A&R guys. And he went on later to become well-respected and well-known as a supplier of music. I don't know what you'd call that, for production music for movies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Sure.
He had an incredible collection. He may still have of rock and roll and original records and 45s and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Were you working, last time we talked about, well, actually, this is the first time we were talking about how you're multi-tracking. Do you know how many original tracks you were working on with this? Like, how many they had available? Was it still
well,
four?
Well, they had more than the first and the second album, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure. I've made this analogy before. When we started, you know, the tapes were about like that,
mm-hmm.
and then they got a little bigger. By the time we finished, the tapes were huge. And I felt like we were shrinking, you know. And then they all went away because they digitized everything, and the studio became a little box you could carry anywhere to record with. But at this point, we probably had, I don't know, 20, 30 tracks maybe, something like that.
Wow.
Not 100,
sure.
Which was later, but we definitely had more tracks to work with.
That's still considerable.
Yeah, which helped us as well to realize the soundscapes that we were hearing in our heads. But what was wonderful fun about this album in particular was that we were comfortable enough in the studio by this point. And we had a contract that allowed us, that granted us free studio time that John McClure had engineered for us, one of the great executives at Columbia who was in charge of spoken arts.
Mm-hmm.
He put us under a spoken arts contract, so we didn't have to pay for studio time in exchange for a slightly reduced royalty. And we were able to write and go into the studio, lay stuff down, listen to it, go back, write some more, kind of stitch it together, what worked, what didn't work. And so the album grew organically, which was a rare opportunity that was granted us at that time.
Yeah.
And unique to us. Nobody else was doing what we were doing, and nobody else had the facility to do it the way we were doing it. So it was a learning curve. We were always learning every time we went into the studios. But you could imagine how exciting it was to be able to write stuff and go in and realize it, you know, and immediately.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, you know, you have to write all your songs and then you go in and you do your album. You could write song by song by song by song by song, you know, and go in and lay them down, and it informed what the next piece was going to be like.
Yeah.
And also, you had the ability to do all the multi-layering and to add voices and music,
yeah,
and all of that to it whenever we were ready to mm-hmm. do that. Was a tremendous freedom for us to be able to create these complex stories on an album. And somebody else also pointed out, this is the first time, as I said, that we actually told a story from side one to side two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is like one theme,
yeah,
one unified theme, which is another reason why this album became so popular, because it was accessible because of the metaphor of television and click, click, click,
sure,
all that. But it also told a coherent story, a more coherent story from beginning to end, and through the life of a day in the life of George LeRoy Tirebiter,
yeah,
a major character. So it was really enlightening for us.
Rolling Stone went batshit over it. They gave you two pages, and Rolling Stone was a much wider, taller magazine.
Yeah. Wow.
And they eventually called it the greatest comedy album ever made in the 80s, like 83 or something like that. And it's true. It really is one of the greatest comedy albums ever made because it's so unique and still is.
Yeah, you know? I mean, even among your other work.
Even among the out of the body of work.
This is your signature piece.
Yeah, now it was followed by, I think, Royal Bozos on This Bus, which is also a very intricate and prognosticative work. But that was inspired in a great part by the success of this album and the fact that the album, again, liberated us to be able to experiment more in the format that we were working in. But there's an obvious reason why this album is in the Library of Congress as an hysterical recording or historical recording, because it really was a cultural envelope breaker. It established a new kind of a format for what you could expect in a phonograph, in a recorded phonograph comedy format.
Yeah.
You know?
It set a really high bar no one had even ever tried to do before.
No. And that's the other interesting thing about Firesign Theater in general. We were never really in competition with other comic forces at the time.
Sure.
Because what we were doing was so totally unique and something that the four of us were in complete agreement about, even though the process sometimes was painful because of, you know, individual egos and ideas.
Of course.
But we were totally united in our understanding that this was something we wanted to do together and a story we wanted to tell in a particular format together. And all the other comedians at the time were basically isolated. A couple of duos around, I guess, but
sure.
Who else was in the bins at the time? Because there are just a few photos in your archive where somebody went in and took a snapshot, probably Phil, because Phil couldn't stop taking snapshots of a bin, and you're right next to W.C. Fields.
Yeah, well, but that was
it would have just been Bill Cosby, wouldn't it?
I think most of the comic geniuses of the time. I'm looking at Phyllis Diller over here.
There'd be some Phyllis. There'd be Jonathan Winters.
Were you know singular people with singular voices and great comic minds. I think, let me think, when did we perform with Steve Martin? When was that? He was starting to do his stuff at that time.
68, 69.
Really?
Yes, yeah. God. There were, I think, that the early 70s were probably a ripe time for individual comedians to do their stuff.
Sure.
When did The First Family come out? When
was that? 63. Nope. Wait. The first one would have been 62, I think, and the second one was 63. Am I wrong? Wait, hold on.
Because that was a concept
album. They might actually both have been 63. My apologies. I literally have 20 copies of it sitting there. I should know. I'm not joking. There are 20 copies of it there.
You should know.
You need to tell everybody in the world of your shame.
Jason, you should know more than anybody something about the chronology of these comedians.
Oh, believe me. Oh, I absolutely should.
So, where do we fit into the panoply?
Feel free to start anytime.
This is recorded in October 62, but if I'm not mistaken, it was released early 63. The other one was recorded shortly after this came out and then released late 63, or spring of 63, and then had a few months before they could no longer sell.
And Newhart was happening.
Newhart was 1960. His first one was 1960.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were already wonderfully established individual comedians doing phonograph records of their routines.
Yeah.
And some of them were conceptual. At least First Family was conceptual.
Yeah, yeah.
And Stan Freberg was conceptual.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it's not as though we were working in isolation. We were inspired by these other great comics.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I think what we added, what Firesign added was the element of silliness and surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
The English approach to comedy, the very verbal and intellectual approach to comedy, and
yeah.
the psychedelic aspect of it as well. So those elements transmogrified what comedy was becoming into our own particular little branch or, you know, stream off the main river.
Yeah.
And when Python burst on the scene, we felt that these were our comic brothers.
Of course.
Again, inspired by the Goon shows in England, and which were highly surrealistic and totally unique and still hold up magnificently well as absurd comedy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And remember, there was also that movement of absurdist theater that was happening at the time. Ubu Hua and
Sam Shepard and John Guare.
Well, in America... Yes, Sam Shepard and John Guare.
And overseas, maybe Stoppard.
And Stoppard. So Bergman had worked with Stoppard in Stoppard, whose real name is Polish. And at the Berlin.
His real name is what?
He was Polish. Stoppard is Polish. Can't remember. You could look up his real name. But he and Peter were at the Berlin Colloquium together, writing together. And then Peter went on to write with Peter Sellers on a television show in England. And for me, I went to Yale with John Guare, and many years later, in the 60s, around 67 or so, I was cast in the ensemble of a play called Musica, which was being done as a Monday night at the Tapers, Mark Taper Forum, in Los Angeles. And Phil Austin and his wife were in this ensemble in their repertory company. And I was then chosen to do the lead in Musica, Jack Argue, which is an anagram of, John Guare. And we did it as a main stage production where I got to work with Barry Chase and with, some of the wonderful actors, I'll think of her name in a minute, and Phil Austin, who was in the ensemble. And at the end, there's this scene where I've been drafted, and Phil Austin and I are in bunk beds getting ready to go out in Vietnam, getting ready to go out on I wasn't in the army, so I don't know, on a something.
Sure. We'll say bivouac. That sounds right.
We'll say
bivouac.
Sortie.
Sortie.
Yes, there we are.
And, and we're putting on makeup, camouflage makeup, except we're putting on clown makeup. and then I kill myself. And I think blood dripped down on Austin in the lower bunk. I can't remember exactly what it was. But working with Phil Austin on the stage, you know,
his
fellow actor, it was wonderful. And that was Sherry North. Sherry North and Barry Chase played this wonderful, funny prostitute part in this thing. Chinese basket job, you likey? And
it's an amazing play. Anybody who has got a couple minutes to go on Alibris or something and look up a book published with Musica and Cop Out and a third play that I can't remember
by John Guare.
Yeah, you can probably get it for $10.
House
bucks.
Of Blue Leaves. Before that, he also wrote Six Degrees of Separation, which was John is a. I'm going to be heading back to New York after this trip to Europe that we're taking, and I'm going to see if I can get in touch with him. I'll be reconnecting with Austin Pendleton, which is how Peter and I first met. And
we were just talking about him last night.
Yeah. And Bob Grossman, who did the art.
Exciting. That is exciting.
For this.
Love that cover. I mean, that cover is equally as memorable as the album.
Yeah, Bob Grossman created the popularity of airbrush art like this. And he was Peter Bergman's roommate at Yale.
So he's to blame, but he's also to thank. So,
and Austin Pendleton, when I was in the Dramat with the likes of Sam Waterston and John Badham and Peter Hunt, Richard Maltby Jr. and Finkel and Whedon, and Tom Ligon and Skip Hinnant and Billy Hinnant and all these wonderful people. And then in the drama school, Joan Van Ark and Dan Travanti, and wonderful actors, and John Guare and blah, blah, blah. When I was doing that, Austin wrote two musicals, one called Tom Jones and one called Booth is Back in Town. And in Tom Jones, I played the lead role, and Bergman co-authored the lyrics. And that's where I first worked with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was class of 61 at Yale. I'm class of 62. And in the next piece, Booth is Back in Town, which is the story of the Junius Brutus Booth, who was a famous actor of his time, and his two children, John Wilkes Booth and Edwin Booth, mm-hmm. who were competing as his sons for leading man. And I played Edwin. Peter wrote all the lyrics for that, which were parodies of late 19th century songs. You know, theater songs and things like that.
If anyone has not heard the soundtrack, Fuji Puzzle Box, the whole album is up.
Is that up there? You
got to listen to it.
That is. TaylorJessen.blogspot.com.
Some damn catchy tunes. Seeing the Elephant.
There's a lot of good stuff.
Seeing the Elephant. Yeah. Anyway, that particular experience of working with those great people was something that really set me on the path of being an actor, because prior to that time at Yale, I was a Russian language major. And I'd gotten to the Soviet Union with the Yale Russian Chorus in my freshman year. So I really had developed a conversational fluency and an opportunity to sing all these great Russian folk songs and things.
Wait, are there any albums of that? I want to know what the first album you're on. Do you know the first album of all that you're on, period?
Yeah, I think it was probably the Yale Russian Chorus.
Taylor, have you heard this? Taylor, have you found it?
We don't have it in the archive. Now I got to find it.
What the hell, Taylor?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I need to hear this.
Pretty sure.
That's amazing.
Have you got it, maybe? Downstairs?
Gosh, I don't know. I don't think so.
If somebody's out there who has it, just contact us, please.
Indeed.
Ooh, hello?
That's a beep. Oh, I think we lost video, but we didn't lose audio. So what's going to happen is we'll have a lot of fun little photos that'll go along with it. Taylor didn't even know there was video happening. Yeah,
I knew there was video happening.
Now Taylor just found a Star Trek tricorder. Now I have to describe visually
Show's
everything
over.
That happens.
So,
but we still.
I am completely.
Audio. It's up. Okay. all right, so. Bourbon, Yale, blah, blah, blah.
Well, do you have some favorite bits that you wrote or anybody wrote? Do you have favorite bits off this album, period?
No. I can never remember. You know, I mean, yeah, sure, Ralph Spoilsport and stuff like that from other albums. I mean, there were certain pieces that I did. You know, Pastor Flash is on this, right? Well, I wrote Pastor Flash. But so often, I had a deli lunch with Andy Thomas and my co-author of the book, Where's My Fortune Cookie, Brad Schreiber, and Richard Schulenberg to discuss certain legal aspects involving Firesign Theater and me as an author and all that. And he pointed out to me something about the four or five crazy guys. Because when you talk about material that we wrote, my assumption was always that the fifth crazy guy was really the owner, the author of most of our material. Because the four of us would collaborate together.
Sure.
And we'd all bring stuff in. But more often than not, in these early days, the authorship would become sublimated by the all of the contributions of each individual writer and performer. Because once we got it up on its feet in the studios, there would be an element of improvisation that would enter into it. And so whoever was speaking the lines or altering the lines or designing them to fit into the particular context of the piece we were doing had a little more ownership than the people who might have written it originally.
Sure.
But the ultimate result to me was the fifth crazy guy. Then Richard Schulenberg says to me, "Oh, no, I'm the fifth crazy guy."
Oh, we're going down a whole Yoko road there. Anybody could say that.
No. The road that he was going down was that when we came up with the name of our publishing companies, one of them was the four or five crazy guys. And that's because Schulenberg was actually a partner in that.
Interesting. Okay.
Why, I'm not exactly sure.
Okay, I see that. That's right.
But you know, so he was a lawyer, and I guess he took a little legalistic slice or something. I don't know. But creatively, I still believe that the reason we came up with that name was because we realized that at a certain point we had to relegate ownership. We had to let go of personal ownership and just embrace the body of the work itself.
Yeah.
You know, but I have performed things independently from various albums, and some of them were definitely my own, but the others, you know, like David Osman and I are the only surviving members of the Firesign Theater at this point. And recently I performed with my wife, Melinda Peterson, by the way, who's in the other room, avoiding hearing all this over and over again. We performed at the Radio Enthusiasts of Puget Sound, the REPS OTR convention.
Uh-huh. Mm.
The Radio Enthusiasts of Puget Sound old-time radio convention.
Sure.
And we had a wonderful weekend a couple of weeks ago up there in Bellevue.
Mm-hmm.
Not the hospital, but the town, although it was pretty crazy. And David came up and participated in Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, which Melinda and I starred in. And he played the painter, the one, you know, she says, not a hospital white, but, you know, an eggshell white. And he go, uh-huh. You know, the scene, I don't know if you know the movie. It's Cary Grant and Myrna Loy.
Okay.
And it's one of the funniest scenes where she goes from room to room describing what color she wants and being so precise. And at one point she says, now here's a piece of thread. This is the red that I want. And he says, now don't lose it because I had left of it. And he goes, uh-huh. And he says, you know, and it's not a crimson red. It's not a candy apple red. It's like, you know, a cardinal red. And he goes, No. It's not a candy apple red. No. It's a cardinal red. Uh-huh. And so at the end of the scene, he says to his assistant, did you get that? And his assistant says, yeah, red, white, yellow, green, blue. It's a wonderful scene. And David was killer in it. So we also performed some fireside material.
Awesome.
For them, because they wanted us to honor us. And the next time that we might perform together, the next time I'm appearing is at the Steve Allen Theater before they tear it down and turn it into condominiums.
Yeah.
On the 29th of June, after I get back from the European trip, as a fundraiser for Trepani Production Company, for Amit, to raise some money for them. Because they're going to have to find a new venue to do their crazy stuff in.
Yeah.
And we're going to show some movies there, too.
That's awesome. Yeah. Okay.
So Taylor will be there to show some movies. It'll be primarily a Q&A. And it's just me. We can't get David down to do it. But in September, apparently a performance is being put together in Washington, D.C.
Really?
Maybe Washington, AC/DC. I'm not sure exactly.
Who knows?
Where
we'll figure it out. Yeah. Can't tell the difference anymore.
With David and me, because we are in process, we hope, of selling our archives, which Taylor has so beautifully preserved for us, to the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
And there seems to be forward momentum in that regard.
Good.
So it'll either be a celebration
of
that announcement,
or
we'll grease the skids to further, you know, hope that we can actually fulfill that desire and get them to buy our archives.
Wonderful.
And that'll be a performance of a piece that I just read in a book that David's going to be coming out with on a Bear Manor Press called The Fighting Clowns of Hollywood, which are his reminiscences of the creation of that particular show.
Wonderful.
And a compilation of scripts that we were working on during that particular period of our history together. And one of the ones that we performed was the Arlie History of Radio show.
Yes.
An Arlie convention in Virginia for NPR.
Uh-huh.
And it was a piece we performed just that one time. And it was the three of us, David and Peter and me, because Phil, who didn't like to fly, although he's flying now, wasn't able to join us there, so we had him in by satellite. But it's a three-man piece.
Uh-huh.
And I said, David, you know, we can combine that. We can make that a two-man piece easily, right, by switching a few roles. And it's very funny.
It is the best the bit where it's the history suddenly starts turning. Yes, the Hindenburg.
The landing
and nothing
of the Hindenburg.
Happens.
Nothing happens.
And back to you.
Right.
one of the best radio jokes.
But it does. It starts from Marconi era.
Oh, and here comes the Lindbergh baby.
Right. Anyway, it's a very funny piece. So I think we're going to adapt that into our performance.
That's wonderful.
At that particular time. Book-wise, there's a whole lot of stuff going down. David has, I think, the Flying Saucer, Saucer, it's called, which will be a a script that he and Phil Austin wrote for the Grateful Dead. Somebody from the Grateful Dead.
The saucer thing, that was on Joe Dante's shelf for a little while.
Yeah?
But he didn't pluck it.
Mm.
Well,
I have not read Austin's Grateful Dead screenplay, though.
That's what I'm thinking of.
It should be interesting.
Yeah, well, anyway, Saucer is going to be published also at Bear Manor Media Press. Mm-hmm. And with David's notes about the writing of it and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got another book. What is the other one? It's another Ronald Reagan murder mystery, I believe.
Yes, Volume 2. The Flying Saucer.
It's a Flying Saucer motif to it, doesn't it? Yes.
It's got Lenny Bruce in it.
Yeah. And I've, besides my biography, my surrealistic psychic biography, Where's My Fortune Cookie? I've written 2 Procter & Bergman books, or fulfilled the books that Peter and I are working on. One mm-hmm. is The Scripts of Power,
mm-hmm.
which is a surrealistic soap opera we did about power in Hollywood back in the 90s, produced on John Hockenberry's Heat program by Ted Bonnet, mm-hmm. who later became Peter's writing and producing partner in a business that they had of doing radio trailers for movies mm-hmm. for many years at Fred Jones Studios. And they're funny as hell.
It's pretty good stuff.
And they really do translate well into reading. But there's also available, you know, a CD of Power mm-hmm. as it was originally broadcast.
Excellent.
In like five-minute segments. It's a wonderful piece. And the other one I wrote is because Ben Omar, who is the head of Bear Manor Publishing, Bear Manor Media, wanted to know if we had an original script of Americathon.
Yeah.
And I found 2 transcriptions of 2 performances. And so I painfully transcribed them, One of them was a video, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Painfully that was done by,
Gilmore.
Steve Gilmore.
Steve Gilmore.
Who did our TV or not TV movie for us. And Martian Space Party mm-hmm. for the Firesign. A good collaborator, just as crazy as we were at the time. And anyway, I got Neil Israel, who directed the film and collaborated with Peter and me to do it, to write a wonderful foreword. And then I put in the Ur material, the original material that was later transmogrified into the film.
Mm-hmm.
But the story of that film, of Americathon, which is a cult classic. I mean, mm-hmm. people still can go to it. There's a lot of great predictive stuff in it, and it has its moments. But basically, Neil Israel had caught a performance of our show, Americathon. For those of you who don't know what that's about, we did a thing called Gothamathon, where we go into a city as Procter & Bergman and say that we had to raise money to save the city. And so that's what we're dedicating our show to tonight. And we'd become various performers. Jerry, who was Peter, was, you know, he'd been up for 24 hours and he was trying to gamely carry on. And I was, I don't know, Gary, a performer. But we had, and then we had all these crazy Procter & Bergman pieces that would come in. So he caught, and then we changed it to Americathon to come up with enough money to save America from bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And Neil caught one of our performances, I think in Boston, and came back. I had done a film with him called Tunnel Vision,
mm-hmm.
right, which is his claim to fame, that also had Chevy Chase in it and Howard Hesseman and, mm-hmm. gosh, so many wonderful people of the time. And it's a cult classic, Tunnel Vision. I played the Christian Broder, the owner of this cable television station
mm-hmm.
that was, you know, being censored by the U.S. government
mm-hmm.
because it had obscenity and all, I mean, nudity and all. It was a real precursor of what was to come. So anyway, Neil sees it and says, I want to make a movie with you guys out of this. It turns out that I was at the time living with Sheila Wells off of Phyllis. She wasn't helping us with that. But off of Phyllis, down Doheny from Sunset. And his offices where we wrote the movie were on Doheny, just up from Phyllis, right? So we're writing the movie there, and it was a good experience until Peter and Neil started clashing, and two Jewish writers, I was the Buddhist writer, but the Amish writer, but two Jewish writers, they started clashing over things, and they were both stubborn about ideas, and he basically wanted to fire, he fired Peter, and he asked me to stay on the project. And I made a tactical error, I freely admit. I should have said to Peter, you know, Peter, if we're going to maintain our voice in this project, I'm going to have to stay with it. Mm-hmm. I'll consult with you, but our voice will still be there. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand. My loyalty to Peter was what I felt more than anything else. And Procter and Bergman, and I said, Neil, I can't do it. I really, you know, Peter's my partner, and I can't. And that was a mistake, because then he hired Pat Proft. Like, well, I'm PP too, you know. And they went on to have great success in all kinds of areas with funny movies and things. But it was a tactical error. I've made many of them in my career, and yet I've had a nice career, still having a nice career. It's fine. Sure. It's okay. Another path opens. But the movie then went in divergent ways from the more surrealistic concept that we had created. And so it's not a great movie, but it's not a bad movie either. And there's a lot of great people in it, you know, Harvey Korman, and I don't even begin to dare. It's all in the book.
Yeah.
It's all in the book.
I just exposed somebody to it last night by giving them my second copy of the soundtrack. So he might discover the movie through the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, and John Ritter, of course, that's right, as the president. No, it's a fascinating, if you Google it, it's a fascinating cast. And if you see it, you know, there are some very interesting things and some good high points. But it's not a Procter & Bergman movie.
Right.
It's based on an idea from Procter.
Right. Okay. We should, I want to make sure we talk a little, I know you said you specifically don't have some favorite bits from this album, but I do. Now, okay. I've had to listen to it, you know, so the first time I heard it was actually when Jeremy Guskin, the delightful Jeremy Guskin, who couldn't be here today, this is the first Fireside album we ever did on this podcast. Ah, okay. And he's like, this is the one my dad exposed me to, said, you have to listen to this. Basically, lay on the floor with headphones on and listen to it. Recently talked about it with a gentleman named Tommy Edison, who is a blind gentleman, blind
Tom
from
Edison.
Birth. Yes, yeah, and he loves this album because I'm blind from birth, and this is just so immersive for him. I'm obviously a latecomer to it, but there's so, and I usually, the dumb jokes are what are going to stand out to me, because I'm an idiot. I mean, I went to college, but I'm still,
You're an educated idiot.
I'm an educated idiot. And I want to ask you, Taylor, first of all, where you heard this first. When did you first hear this album? Do you know?
I first heard this album on QE, KUOI FM in Moscow, because it was either my third or my fourth
year. Moscow, Idaho. It wasn't Russian.
Procter & Bergman came up in 75, and then 20 years later, I talked to Procter on for the first time on the phone, and he said, "Oh, you're in a station in Moscow. Let me do an ID for you. So here's Perestroika. He's going to do the ID. No, Perry. Wait, it's Moscow, Idaho, not Moscow, Russia.
Oh, I forget."
When Procter & Bergman came out, Procter said, hey, we have a little announcement here for the Moscow area. There, I hope that's clear, and everybody up here in Moscow will hop to.
Yes, it will. Что ты по-русски говоришь?
Нет, нет, нет.
Нет, это было прекрасно, знаете. Произношение прекрасное.
They had a wonderful station.
I didn't know you spoke Russian. My God, it's very good. He said, oh, no. No, your pronunciation was wonderful.
That's exactly the same way you did. That's the only way I know.
That's the only way you can do it.
It's an amazing station, free format, and they had a big comedy library in the back, and there were 2 or 3 inches worth of Fireside on the shelf.
Awesome.
And this was the period where I was buying my own comedy LPs.
See, size does matter, folks.
It's true.
Yeah.
The more inches on your shelf, well, Fireside's up to 5 feet now. there's so much Fireside real estate up there. I was playing Python albums. I was playing Steve Martin albums, very carefully editing out the fucks on the air.
Oof.
And then here comes Fireside. I wonder what's going on with this? And I was hooked straight from electrician because of Let Me Hear It For Me, You're Under Arrest. It's like the door slammed. Yes, I'm in this room forever. And then I went through them chronologically, and that was the first time I heard Dwarf, and I played it without previewing it, and didn't get any calls except from one Vietnam vet who said it reminded him of when he was in Nam stoned off his ass.
Really?
Yeah,
really, that's amazing.
So that was the first time I heard it.
Wow.
The Fucks are pretty quiet on this album. So I know that sure. it's dedicated to the F-CC.
Yeah. But that's true.
They're pretty great, though.
You could play this on the air and get away with it,
Fuck
I think.
Fuck you.
Question, oh, no! It was that's another reason for our success, was that about the time that we were starting to reach national recognition, FM radio reared its ugly head.
Yeah.
And the whole stereo world opened up.
Sure.
And college stations were from the first to really discover it and to exploit it.
Okay.
And they could play our stuff because it wasn't nationally broadcast.
Right, right.
But remember, the whole impetus for our career was based on the fact that you'd listen to this in the privacy of your own home.
Sure, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that was how we got around the whole... Little did we expect, that a long-form comedy LP like this would actually become played in its entirety on broadcast
sure.
media,
yeah.
You know? So that was a big surprise for us. Now, one of the reasons why Procter & Bergman broke off from Fireside Theater was that we had two things that we wanted to achieve. One, we wanted to tour more.
Mm-hmm.
And since Phil was uncomfortable flying and liked to travel with his wife and his dogs and his van, mm-hmm. that severely restricted our ability to hop around from place to place and take advantage of the audiences that were out there for us.
Mm-hmm.
And also Phil and Dave wanted to do another album. We were not adverse to doing another album, but we felt if we just stay as a recording group, you know, and then go out sporadically for tours that we can design around Phil's availability or ability to get to the venue by the time we're performing,
yeah.
It, you know, it's going to be more of the same old, and we're not going to expand our base. So we knew we had to create our own material, and our first album was TV or Not TV, which was, when I think of it, first done as an album before we created a show based on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept behind it was kind of a hybrid in that, yes, it was going to be a story with, you know, reoccurring characters or established characters, Fred Flam and Clark Cable. And yes, it was going to predict the idea of 100 channels.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, 500 now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and cable television and all that stuff. And yes, it was also going to predict piracy, you know, which has not happened to the same degree. Happened more, less on television and more on radio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pirate stations and mm-hmm. things like that.
Sure.
And kids getting hold of, mm-hmm. of cameras and you know, taping infantile programs and things like that. Well, mm-hmm. that's come true.
Mm-hmm.
Except that they're just infantile adults, really.
but
out of that, we designed a show that was bits.
Yeah.
And drop-ins. We said, you know, if we want to expand the base of Firesign from our celebrity, if we can offer them short bits that can be played on the radio,
mm-hmm.
like traditional comic drop-ins,
mm-hmm.
we'll have a better opportunity to reach a wider audience. And that's still happening.
Yeah.
When I get royalties now, from a service called Sound Exchange,
mm-hmm.
invariably it'll be 90% Procter & Bergman played on XM radio or Sirius or what have you, and then 10% Firesign. Because
wow.
it's hard to excerpt Firesign.
Sure it
you
is.
Know?
Yeah.
And yet,
you have to look for the specific excerpt collections, and it's
exactly.
really just shoes for industry.
That's
really.
Right. There's only
I put together that drop-in CD a few years ago,
yeah.
which is like 75 minutes of all drop-in
yeah.
stuff, and I wish we could release that commercially, but it's got one... A lot of it is Sony and a little bit of it is Mercury.
Oh,
so
it's one
just
going
to have to be one of those promo-only things.
I know. This was, in a way, it's a mistake that we made in not saying... You know, let's put out this kind of an album with Sony
mm-hmm.
or with Mercury
mm-hmm.
drop in so that you can, you know, we can expand our playability on the air. And we didn't do that. But we did put out that wonderful 45 Forward Into the Past,
mm-hmm.
which is funny little radio excerpts.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there are areas where had we. My supposition was that, have we been able to sustain management, we might have been able to do more things like this.
Sure.
But because of the personalities of the four men, it was pretty much impossible to agree on a management company that satisfied everybody's, mm-hmm. you know, vision mm-hmm. of what it is we should be doing together.
That makes sense. You know? That makes sense.
Yeah, but we worked with some great people like James William Guercio, mm-hmm. you know, and Larry Fitzgerald with him. And we had opportunities to work with some highfalutin managers along the way, but it just... It was pretty much an unmanageable group of crazy hippies when you get down to it.
I do think, I don't know, I've had to, first of all, I don't know why I found a mention of Laughing Cow Cheese so funny. I don't know why that was so funny to me, but what are we going to do, Lieutenant? What are we going to do, Lieutenant? What are we going to do, Lieutenant? I don't know why that's so fucking funny to me, but that is one of those things where, like, I want to see how it's written. Those are the kind of jokes where I'm like, how the fuck did they put that on paper? Because
that one is Zen perfection, it really is.
That, and then what is reality? When somebody yells out from the crowd, what is reality? That is,
I'm glad.
I mean, that's all a fire sign in one line. Really, I mean, that is fucking...
That probably should be on my tombstone, right? For years I thought it'd be too hip for the room, but what is reality is as good as any other epitaph.
I'll go with whichever direction you decide to favor. But
boy, what is reality is
it's a great line.
I ask myself that every morning.
Of course.
Well, what's extraordinary about this album is mm-hmm. that there's certain lines on here that are better historical summaries than whole books. I mean, if you want to understand the Indian genocide in America, you only need one line. Uh-huh. Here's the lovely Trail of Tears golf course.
Yeah.
This whole album is packed with little things like that just detonate.
Yeah, it's true. There was always an ability of the group to synthesize cultural ideas and social ideas mm-hmm. for maximum effect, because what we were trying to do was to be both subliminal and subversive at the same time.
Sure.
And that was politically a conscious decision that we made, to be subversive and subtle, so that stuff could zip by and certain minds would hear them, mm-hmm. and certain other minds would not hear them.
Sure.
And that's why, you know, we acquired such an incredibly intelligent and dedicated following.
Yeah.
During the course of our experience in releasing records.
In those days, who else in your league would say was operating in such a subversive bag? Because I can only think of...
Subversively?
Maybe Credibility Gap.
Yes, I would say the Credibility Gap. Yeah. And remember, we worked in alliance with them, strange mm-hmm. association with them, because Richard Beebe, who was a newsman, helped to create the Credibility Gap. And there's somebody else, there's another name. Earth News, who did
Lou Irwin?
Lou Irwin,
yeah,
right. Visionaries, really, who were trying to do a hybrid transition between hard news and surrealistic comedy, and they succeeded really in the Credibility Gap, and Harry Shearer is maintaining the tradition mm-hmm. with remarkable consistency through all these years, but. Not they were performing at KRLA when we were performing, and we would do the Radio Free Oz show, and then they would come on, I think, before the news or after the news, and do a little surrealistic comedy news thing, right? Yeah. And when we were performing at the Ash Grove, that was another venue where they would work out
interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I'd go down and watch them work, you know.
Did you ever meet the guys in Conception Corporation?
Yeah, I think I did. And there was another group, too. The other Proctor and Ward.
Oh, yeah.
Up in Santa Barbara.
Osman and Austin worked with them a little bit.
Proctor
That's
and
some
Ward.
Funny stuff.
And the Elephant. What was the one with the Elephant name? Let's see. The Dudley Do-Right Players in Milwaukee. You know, something like that. You know, again, this is an area that would... be fun for you to investigate what other groups were extant at the time that we were inspired by Fireside Theater
yeah
and went to.
I've been trying to pick that apart. Well, I mean, that's the only one I could think of first was credibility gap, especially because Harry Shearer, when he did this podcast, mentioned that time when he got what was the article where they said,
"Oh, right." Oh,
was it they,
the way that you do not make the credibility gap happy is write a big article about them and then say they're the Firesign Theater.
Yeah, yeah, yep. So I don't remember which were they talking
he
about.
He told me about like the date of the article, and I immediately went to the Firesign Archive to see if we had a copy.
You don't have it. Damn it.
I also in this context, I also have to mention Albert Brooks.
Sure.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he's a genius in my mind.
Sure.
And out of my mind too, and he created some very interesting conceptual albums as well, and has a unique voice. Still has a unique voice, and I love what he did in the movies. I loved it. Of course, his name is Einstein, Albert Einstein. So, a good series, by the way, if you want to watch a good series on National Geographic, the Genius, it's called, Story of Albert Einstein. We're enjoying it very much. And you don't have to be a genius to watch it, because it's his, you know, his romantic escapades and his growing up and everything. It's very interesting.
I will say contemporary to Albert Brooks, so like I'm starting more to appreciate Lily Tomlin's albums because
that's really another
genius.
Because I mean, to make an album wherein the entire premise is she's being interviewed about the making of her album, fuck you, that's too good. Yeah. That is just, and then like to mix it in with live performance and that, which is so hard to do.
It's good that you brought up Lily, because 70 is the year that Dwarf and This Is a Recording.
This Is a Recording also came out.
This Is a Recording won the Grammy.
You know, I have to reacquaint myself with that because
it's a good album. It's funny, but it's also it's kind of, I mean, it's skitty, and some of it, I hate to be the bearer of the news of a laugh track, but there's extra laughter that they added to this live performance she did at the Ice House.
But Modern Scream has got. I mean, I don't know if that's her best. Is it what's? I've heard you probably heard more of them than I have, Taylor. But
well, there's just the four that I know of. But Modern Scream is amazing.
Yeah.
And then there's And That's the Truth, which is based on her.
And That's the Truth. Yeah.
I can't remember what the kid's name is.
Ellen.
Fuck.
God, she was on Sesame Street too. I think.
Me too.
Or Electric Company or something.
Any other time, I could have literally told you the name.
And then there's On Stage, which is excellent.
Edith Ann.
Edith Ann.
Jesus.
See, I got the E right. So.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
It was a start.
So, I mean, I was just trying to research sketch comedy.
Well,
I was trying to find other ones.
Again, I mean, all of these people, we were in our own bubble, driven to, you know, to continue to develop a particular kind of surrealistic comedy. There's no doubt about it. And yet, we were as influenced as everybody else by these other great comedians, who were turning out stuff at the time, and also expressed various degrees of surrealistic understanding. There was one unfortunate thing. I met Lily not too long ago. They did a version of her one woman show about the aliens.
Intelligent Life in the Universe.
Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe.
Okay, yep.
Down at the LGBT Center in Hollywood, they did a multicast version of it that was very effective.
Yeah.
Okay, and she was there with the author the night that we were there, and so we got to say hello to Jane and to her. And she had come to see, she was going to do a television show. And she did with, remember Barry, Dr. Demento was part of it.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a light fantasy little variety.
Interesting, okay.
She wanted to work with Firesign Theater. And she came to see us at the Roxy. And we were doing, I don't know, maybe the Owl and Octopus Show or Men in Hats or one of our more obscure.
Late 70s.
Sure, yeah, late 70s. Scripts of which, by the way, will be available in David Ostman's Fighting Clowns of Hollywood.
Awesome.
That's going to be a good book.
Really, wonderful. The scripts that he has been able to assemble, God bless him. Are just wonderful. I was roaring as I read through this stuff and going like, this is funny.
That's
exciting. Who wrote this shit? You know? And to think that we memorized it and performed it. And he writes agonizingly in his diaries about how exhausting it was to do this.
I bet.
You know, and how, you know, all of us had different attitudes about it. I was surly, you know, and combative, and Austin was depressed, and Bergman was trying to find something else to do. And, you know, it's really funny to read one member's, you know, observations of these things from his psyche, what was going on, because we all have different observations, of course. But ultimately, she came to see this Roxy show, and we did a piece in there. It was Austin and Bergman, I think, where two women playing tennis, and we were making jokes about menstruation. And that turned
out. That was it?
Wow. That was it. That was the end of it.
Yeah.
So you go like, oh, gosh, you know, wow, okay, well. And she's right. I mean, maybe we shouldn't have done jokes about menstruation, but women menstruate, and there's comedy there, you know.
Yeah.
But if Sarah Silverman does it, you know, it's acceptable. If Phil Austin does it, it's questionable.
right.
So, but and there's another thing, too, which is the difference between performance and audio performance. You can get away with a lot more stuff in audio performance than you can when you're performing live on the stage.
Sure.
And you can do more live on the stage than you can get away with in audio.
Yeah.
So there's a balance. And I think that's one of the things that was interesting about Firesign experience over time, which was that we were attracted to performance.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also experimenting with ways, like Lily Tomlin did in her album, to meld live performance with studio.
Yeah.
What's the word I even want there? Studio performance is one way to put it, but there are things you can... Augmentation. There's a word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
With the kinds of augmentations that you can create taking live material and studifying it, you know, like in our Eight Shoes, in Fighting Clowns, the album, with that extraordinary artwork by the late Phil Hartman, we took a live show, my God, where we had a band on stage at the Roxy and sang the four of us, sang, you know, punk rock and jazz music and rock and roll. I mean, my God. And ballads and things. Incredible. And then took it into the studio and jazzed it up and added little skits and things around it and all that, you know, with more control. Fred Jones, bless his heart. And it's beautifully blended together.
Yeah.
And you don't know where it comes from. We do it as a live performance, and there's a live audience, not augmented. But it goes other places.
Yeah.
It goes other places that you can't always do on stage.
Sure. I mean, as long as it's done for the art of the piece and not just, like we're talking about, just like, here's some extra laughs we didn't get. Like, that's the hard part, where it's just like, let's if you're oomphing everything else for the effect of the home listener, I mean, what the hell's
wrong
with
that? Well, she probably didn't even have any control.
Oh, I'm sure she didn't.
Oh, no.
Oh, I'm sure she
didn't. That was her first album.
Well, that's why you get to Modern Scream, and it's like, oh, she got to do some shit. Like, and that's, it's a solid
album. Now, the
album.
One time that we worked with a laugh track was when we worked with Milton Berle on the National Lampoon radio show.
Oh, my God.
And we did a piece called Joke Squad.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure who even wrote it. Maybe David Shepard. But Phil and Peter and I, David was, pardon me, I keep hitting this microphone.
It's okay.
David was in Washington, I think, doing his NPR show at the time. And Milton Berle. So it's Milton Berle and Pete and Phil and I in, I think, in Fred Jones Studios in Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset. Pardon me, in Hollywood off of Sunset. And Milton brought his laugh machine guy with him.
Really?
Yeah. And he had, this laugh machine guy had this little box with the little levers on it and things and knobs and all. And he would be in another part of the studio, probably the other side with the engineer.
Uh-huh.
And Milton would say, because the premise of this piece was, we're the joke squad, we arrest Milton Berle for stealing material.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out he's stealing it from himself.
You know?
So we have to, he has to do a routine,
mm-hmm.
To kick off this skit. So he does one of his routines, and he would say, after a run through, he'd say, so Earl, whatever the guy's name was, he said, I want to titter after the judge joke, and then the woman, put the woman in and I'll come make a comment. Okay. So he'd say something like, my uncle, he was a psychic. He knew the day he was gonna die. A judge told him.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be a laugh, mm-hmm. and then a woman would go, oh, you liked that one, did you? Well, listen to this. You see, and he could design.
Oh my God!
It was wonderful. It was flawless.
It's almost an art on its own.
Of course, it was a great art. You know,
that's crazy,
and perfectly in keeping with the mystique of stand-up comedy.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Did he know who you guys were? Did he?
Oh,
have
yeah.
Any? Yeah. That's oh, yeah. awesome.
And he told us, you know, the standard stories of mm-hmm. how long his schlong is.
Of course.
The favorite story was, he said, we had a contest, you know, with, let's see, a couple of people who were known for long schlongs. And in the contest, you'd go into like a sauna and you'd just be wearing a robe uh-huh. and you have a manager. Your managers would be in there with you. And then at each one in turn, you take it out and show it and see which had the biggest schlong. And his manager says to Milton, he says, just take out enough to win the contest.
Love it. I love it so much. God damn it.
Which apparently he could, you know.
I have, this is a total side note, and I apologize. We already got sidetracked anyway. I do have a friend who now owns Milton Berle's Powder Puff, like his famous powder
oh,
puff from
no,
the TV
really?
Show. Yes.
Makeup!
Won it at an auction, and I saw it. It's just like this giant, it's an amazing thing to own that kind of shit.
Yeah, you know? I remember the little guy with his hat on backwards or something. He used to run in and hit him with it, you know. I mean, listen, I grew up watching this stuff on
sure.
television. I grew up listening to the radio.
Yeah.
I was so lucky. I having been born in 1940.
Right, perfect transition period.
I grew up listening to the radio, and I remember a story I've also told several times. The end of the war, mm-hmm. end of the Second World War, right before we surrendered, I was in Goshen, Indiana, and with my family, my mother, my dad, and other relatives. And all of a sudden, the radio, which was playing music, was interrupted by an announcement of some sort. And then they played music again, and everybody was cheering and dancing, and they got out the drinks, and they were drinking
yeah.
and hooting and hollering. I said, what happened? What happened? The war in Europe is over. What? I was like five,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Vaguely.
Where's
but
my
I remember
fucking little orphan Annie?
To this
that's
day, the energy mm-hmm. of that, you know, mm-hmm. of course I would, you know.
That's amazing.
It was absolutely wonderful. And then listening to the radio in New York, I had a radio, as many of us did, right next to my bed. So at night I could listen to the radio, especially the horror story, you know, the suspense and the detective things and all that. And in the morning, I'd wake up, you know, to Jack Armstrong or Hi-Ho Silver right there next to it. And I imagined that inside this little glowing radio by my bed were these little studios.
Love it.
With all these people. It's so funny. You know, because I knew the reality of radio because
mm-hmm.
my dad would take us to radio shows. We saw Arthur Godfrey from the sponsor's booth, and I saw a live, wasn't a Henry Aldridge, might have been a Jack Armstrong. Anyway, it was a sitcom on the radio.
So good.
And I remember the first scene was taking place in the rain. It was at Radio City Music Hall in New York. And the actors came out with umbrellas.
So
and that
great.
Was, I kind of went like, aha.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is why I try to, when I do audio performances,
mm-hmm.
I try to the best of my ability, with minimal props and costumes,
sure,
where it's not going to be distracting, but will augment the performance.
Of course.
I'll add an element of that to
That's
make things
so
clear.
Good.
And I had a wonderful opportunity recently. I was asked by the SAG-AFTRA Radio Players, SARP, to direct a Firesign Theater piece for volunteers from SAG-AFTRA, actors and actresses,
mm-hmm.
who are part of this workshop program to learn how to do live audio theater.
Awesome. Okay.
And Bill Cates
mm-hmm.
and David, what's David's last name? anyway, but Bill Cates was the Bill has worked with with Taylor over there. Bob Telford. Bob Telford has been it's been like his baby to really put this program together. And so Bill Cates and I put together an evening with the Firesign Theater or something like it, which was a compilation of pieces stitched together in a certain way, ending with Bozos and the destruction of the fair, future fair. And I cast three minority girls, a Latina girl, Valentina, wonderful, a Asian American girl, Patricia, and a black girl whose name is Carla with a K. That's your professional name, Carla with a K.
Love it.
And then Jamie Alcroft, my partner in Boomers on a Bench, to essay the David Osman roles, Catherwood and all, because he's a perfect mimic too, as well as, you know, bring his own thing to it. David Steele, who was the Nick Danger character, an older actor with gravitas, and a good sense of humor, and Bill Cates, who played the doctor in Beat the Reaper, and and the president, as well, and nailed it. Bob Telford. Bob is Bob Telford, excuse me. Bob Telford, who also played announcers in other parts. And who else was in it with me? Oh, and Townsend Coleman.
Really? Love it.
Oh, what a talent.
That
you know?
A guy I've been wanting to get on the show for a long
time. Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, well, I can help you to get him on the show.
I mean, that's why I mentioned him. I mean, he's in the Ninja Turtles, so as a little kid, like, I grew up with
him.
Yeah, the,
he was the Tick.
He's the Tick,
and,
of course.
And he got the fire. He helped to get the Firesign Theater on the Tick. We did two of them, and then I did
so
one.
Great.
I have an action figure of one of the characters I played on the Tick. The Chair.
Right.
The evil villain, The Chair. So there's an action figure of me as The Chair.
That's amazing.
What do I do? Nothing. You can sit on me, you know. But Townsend, brilliant. He just, and he has said, I gave him Peter Bergman's hat, his Bradshaw hat.
Wonderful.
And he said he just was so touched by that. And he
bet
it on his head. And
that's great.
So anyway, a great cast, wonderful people. And what I did was I added the elements of the costumes and the bozo noses and, you know, and various things to differentiate the characters. Oh, yes. And then we had another wonderful actor named Keith who looks like Barney. I mean, he's a rotund, broad-faced Irish guy with red hair and everything, ruddy complexion, and a wonderful actor, wonderful character actor. And he just brought such vivacity to the part, of all the parts that he did. And it was a thrilling experience for me to be able to work with other actors and to tell them, reveal to them what's funny about what they're saying. It's not always clear.
Sure, sure.
And where it came from and where it's going and what the character sounds like. And sometimes it was just like, no, your signs, your freeway signs. So what do? You just talk. You're a sign.
Yeah.
You're a sign. They're all trying to act it. I said, no, you're a sign. Just say it.
Yeah.
Just say it. And it's about the rhythm, and then the outbreak of the rhythm and the rhythm. And so directing it was a joy.
That's amazing.
Plus, I also played Clem you know, various other roles during the... Nancy was played by Patricia, a beautiful, beautiful Asian girl. Very well played. Anyway, it was great, great fun to bring Firesign alive with other actors. And it worked like dynamite. But what it also did was... it showed the people who have been working in the SARP program what they can do beyond just presenting old-time radio scripts and how they can make them more exciting through the use of microphone choreography, costumes, you know, broader characterizations.
Yeah.
And I really was grateful because they got it. And I'll probably direct some more straight material at some point because I want to continue to bring these kinds of understandings to stand up live audio theater.
Yeah, that's amazing. I would love to see some of that.
It was a great opportunity. And of course, it was mainly open to after SAG people,
mm-hmm.
but you could bring guests in as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a recording of it, which I'll share with you both.
Please. Love to hear it.
As long as you know it's non-broadcast. It's
of course,
fine.
Of course.
Because Bill Cates, who is a terrific producer, very bright and wonderful collaborator, he took the recording, the raw recordings of the performance, and he augmented them, and he edited them so that they're tight, you mm-hmm. know, where there was a little drop cue or something, because it's a live performance.
Sure.
Or there's a cue where somebody's moving and something is happening.
Yeah.
And he just did a wonderful job.
That's awesome.
Of putting this in together. Cool. So what I should do is I'll make an MP3 of it, if that's the way I can do it, and send it.
That'd be great.
Cool. Yes.
But... okay, so how are we doing?
We're fine. I want to, you know what I'll do is I'm going to leave this up to Taylor this time. I want you to tell the audience why they should listen to this album. Let's say they haven't heard Firesign, don't know anything about it. Why listen to Dwarf first?
If you've never listened to Firesign, absolutely start with this album, because it's the centerpiece of the reason why they're important. You'll laugh a lot, obviously, but mostly your brain will turn about 35 degrees.
Yep.
It will have that effect on you, just because it's not just a comedy album. It's a really tight, driven piece of drama that mm-hmm. really gets a bow tied on it at the end. Everything that's mm-hmm. set up is delivered. Yep. It's a really strong... it's a strong single piece, and yeah. it is
what you reminded me of when you talk about like the resolution of the piece, the arc of the piece. The final message is really one of resistance, because the story of George Roy Tirebiter, the actor, is that he rebelled against one of the roles he was asked to play,
mm-hmm.
in Parallel Hell. Mm-hmm. Which is a war movie he was cast in as Lieutenant somebody or another. He is asked to, has a line which is, we're going to go out and kill, and he can't say it.
Yeah.
He won't say it. Kill the gooks. He won't say it.
Yeah.
He can't say it. And he is brought up, he is fired, and he is brought up for breach of contract, and there's a whole jury scene, a whole
mm-hmm.
about it. And he basically... lost his career because of his own moral choice.
Yeah.
And there he's sitting watching all of this and remembering all of this,
mm-hmm.
what the choices that he made and what happened to him and everything. And the album ends with him reverting to his childhood again, because an ice cream truck in the morning,
yes,
when he
right.
finally wakes up out of this fevered dream, mix of reality and memory and reminiscence, an ice cream truck has come up into his sector, and he hasn't eaten all night because he couldn't get any Arnie beef halves we deliver, because they don't deliver up there. So he goes running out on the street after it, and his voice gets younger and younger and younger.
Yeah.
Hey, mister, wait for me. And it's a really sweet mm-hmm. ending. So it's a whole cycle of, you know, birth and rebirth. And
yeah.
It's lovely.
And it's you can listen to it in that way. Over and over again, if you choose to, because it works. It works cyclically.
By
I think
God,
it's fun.
Since we did it in 1970, it's still pertinent.
Yeah.
You know, what other, you know, comedy albums can you find pertinent? You find them more like their museum pieces,
right?
You know, redolent of the
time. I mean, that's just the thing. I mean, I've been listening to a comedy album a day for the year, so I'm a little behind. But I mean, I'm past 100 right now, and most mm-hmm. of them, even if they're quote unquote good, they're not re-listenable. I mean, I had a friend come over yesterday, so I could give him a bunch of my old comedy albums, because why bother? I mean, the only fire signs he got were my duplicates, you know? Like, uh-huh. there are these other ones where just, some great comics where it's just, this was fun, it works for that time,
yeah.
I have no
yeah.
need for it anymore.
Fire sign is going to keep you emotionally involved
yeah.
over the years. You will have a reason to go back to it, because there will be a resonance in it that isn't funny, that is just simply a part of your life that is real.
Mm-hmm. It's revealing, and it does, it's relevant. A lot of the stuff that we did is relevant to human existence.
I think so, yeah.
And to trying to make your way in society and in life. Now,
and the bits that are funny are the ones that are going to continue to be, because they are subversive.
Yeah.
And they and they stay subversive, and it remains useful in your daily life to just look at your goddamn motherfucking TV and say, just shout, what is reality at it? And that's never not going to work.
Yeah,
it's true. But we were conscious of the fact that we wanted to do a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
A spectrum. There we go. A spectrum of comedy.
Spectrum.
from the lowest pun, the groaner,
yep,
up to the highest arcane reference,
mm-hmm,
that, you know, only one person in 100 might get and laugh at.
Yeah.
You know. And the result of that was that many people would say to us, I didn't think anybody thought the way I did until I heard your album.
Right.
And it made me feel much more confident about how I was observing life and living life.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I had, you know, I was not isolated. There are other people in the world who think like me.
Yeah.
And there are couples who got married because of that, you know, throwing out fire sign theater lines at a party or something, you know. So, and that still happens, which is fascinating. I'm going to have to wrap this up because I have to go back and deal with the horror of not being online.
Of no online, yeah, sure.
But before we take our trip next Thursday to London, and then to Vienna to celebrate on May 24th, our 25th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we're going to see the Lippes and the Horses, mm-hmm, and we're going to see a Mozart concert, and we're going to see Beethoven's Fidelio, mm-hmm, at the Opern House right across from the hotel we are staying at. And then we're going with some Canadian friends of ours on a motor trip through Switzerland.
Wow.
And I'm going to get to visit Bern, Bear, where my Amish ancestors come from.
Really?
The Jotters. I'm a Yoder.
Uh-huh.
Cool.
And so that, and I've never been there. I won a trip to Switzerland on The Dating Game with Deborah Wally.
Yes, you mentioned that, right. Yeah.
And I had to turn it down because of some fire sign commitment.
You might have gotten killed.
You want to hear the sound of
you
one hand clapping?
You might have gotten killed with Chuck Barrett.
Yeah, I just hit myself in the forehead. And then after that, I'm flying back to New York, and we're taking a limo up to Yale, where I'll be emceeing Talent Night at my 55th Yale reunion.
Really? That's mm-hmm awesome.
And after that, back to New York, where I hope to connect up with Austin and Pendleton and Bob Grossman and so many other wonderful friends who are there. I will be speaking as a guest speaker at the graduation of my elementary school, Alan Stevenson School on East 78th Street, where I went to school from 1948 to 1955.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I'll be speaking to, this is the hardest speech I've ever written, because, but I'm going to start it with, good morning, fellow kids.
As you should, as
right?
You should.
Because my basic message is, don't grow up, please. Please.
Yeah.
If there's any message I can give you, stay open in your mind and your body and your spirit, you know, and play as much as you possibly can with life, because it's all you got. This is it.
It's hard enough growing old.
Yeah,
you know, why bother? So I also would say, real quick, this album, I don't think we'd have The Simpsons without this album. I think we're pretty confident that that's the case. We know Matt Groening's a big fan, and this has that kind of, exactly what we're talking about, the high, the low brow, but all to coming together for one cohesive point. And, you know, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't. It's also a very pretty cover.
It's
very pretty cover.
Bob Grossman really
damn iconic.
Now, the next time we get together will be, I think we're all bozos on this bus,
mm-hmm,
which, of course, is very predictive about the whole computer revolution. And
hell yeah.
And,
I'm excited about that.
Yeah. I can remember that one pretty well for some reason.
I think
because we performed it so many times.
Okay.
You know, we did not perform it. Well, because I'm talking about,
We'll save it for the next episode.
We'll save it for the next time.
I don't want to burn it. If we burn it, then, you know, people get angry at me. No. They won't get angry. But anyway.
You'll want to hear it.
Exactly. So I will make sure then that this comes out before what did we say, June 29th? Because, okay, so I'll do that. And then that, because we've already talked about what you're doing.
Yeah, because it's a fundraiser and people are welcome to come and see the show at the Steve Allen Theater.
That's great.
Out there at the end of Hollywood.
I need to go see that.
You should be there.
I'll
be there.
That'll be fun. Well, thank you very much for being here, Phil, as always.
Nice to be here. Taylor. Glad I'm still here.
Me too.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, Taylor.
Here, here.
You're always helpful.
Where?
Taylor does a lot of work.
Taylor is an angel. He's our angel.
He's the best. And thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit StolenDress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on Facebook.com/ComedyOnVinyl, Twitter @ComedyOnVinyl, and find everything else at ComedyOnVinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit StandUpRecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.